From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, how Firing Line host Margaret Hoover hopes the reprisal of the classic show helps Americans remember what it's like to discuss ideas.
Those two things combined, the partisan media combined with the partisan politics, perpetuates the sort of tearing apart of our civic discourse. And that's why what we do at Firing Line can only be on PBS, in a way.
Essayist Art Sear thinks about Lincoln's first Thanksgiving proclamation. Bubbler Talk finds out about St. Nick's Day. And bioethicist Craig Klugman explains why observation is so crucial in the practice of medicine.
A lot of medicine is just looking at people. You come up with a differential diagnosis based on their symptoms, but sometimes just looking at a person, you can see what fits, what doesn't fit. And as a patient, to be seen is a really profound experience.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first this news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The iconic PBS program, Firing Line with William F. Buckley, ran from 1966 to 1999. The show was known as a platform for debate and discussion for everything from politics to philosophical issues with all the experts. With over 1,000 programs in the archive at the Hoover Institution, it has quite the legacy. 20 years later, political commentator and analyst Margaret Hoover leads the new reprisal. Firing Line with Margaret Hoover maintains the character of the original show, featuring guests from the left and right sides of debates to have a rigorous and civil exchange of ideas. Margaret Hoover was in Milwaukee last month for a Milwaukee PBS event, and she took some time to speak with me on site. Hoover begins by explaining what excited her the most about taking part in leading the new Firing Line.
Many people don't realize it was the longest-running television program in television history with a single host. It lasted even longer than Johnny Carson. So I was, as a young person growing up, aware of Buckley, aware of Firing Line. My parents watched it from time to time. But I was, sadly young enough that I wasn't part of the conservative movement that came up through William F. Buckley's direct fingerprints. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have a personal relationship. I didn't know William F. Buckley. I've met his son since then and find him delightful, and I'm very grateful for his support for the program. But I didn't know Buckley. But I've come to know him, I feel, very intimately, because I have gone through scores, hundreds of his old programs. There are 1,504 episodes of Firing Line, and they are all archived at the Hoover Institution, which is a public policy think tank founded by Herbert Hoover, my great-grandfather, at Stanford University. So just watching these old programs, I've gotten such a great sense of Buckley and his wit and his affect and his sense of humor and his quick-mindedness. I mean, this was the thing that even he gave himself credit for. If he was nothing else, he was quick. He was very, very quick on his feet. And I feel like I've really gotten to know him in a way, but we're our own show. We're different. I'm not Buckley. I'm not trying to be Buckley. I have no interest in being Buckley. Nobody can be Buckley. I think many people have discovered that nobody can be Buckley. And what we are trying to do is riff from something that he bequeathed us, which is a long-form exchange of ideas where you can really dive deep into issues of the day that are important to public policy and important to all of our lives. And it's sort of amazing that television and news and media have become so fast, and the news cycle has become so crowded that news consumption is crammed full of things that often are just skin deep. And so what I found in the sort of resurrection of Firing Line is that what's old is new again. You know, there was a kernel of wisdom in what Buckley was doing that we've kind of forgotten. And it's just take a moment to have a long-form exchange of ideas, by the way, with people that we don't always agree with. Because that contest of ideas provides for a far more rich and nuanced approach to issues. And by the way, I think that's what we recognize, especially at a national level, we're all deeply missing.
What are your biggest influencers or inspirations of hosts from different programs that you look to for inspiration, for ideas? Who did you research when you were looking into playing this host role?
I researched Buckley a lot because nobody's really done this. Only Buckley's done this. But I just think you have to be yourself, right? I don't think you can pretend to be anybody else or study anybody else or try to riff from anybody else. I think you just have to. So I can't say there's particularly one person that I look to in terms of their performance ability. I just think it's the kind of thing that the only way to learn to ride a bike is to start riding a bike.
What have you found to be, pleasantly surprising in this new role for yourself as with this new challenge of being a host?
I mean, what I've found is, shockingly, there's nothing else like this on television, even still. And the audience has really responded. I mean, people like being able to hear, see different people and engage in what is a respectful exchange of ideas. I think that people are very thirsty for content. I think people are thirsty for smart conversation. I think people are thirsty for a well-researched approach to issues. People who are interested in a pragmatic approach to solving problems. So, I mean, that was the thesis. That was our central thesis. But it's been proved correct.
What topics intrigue you the most? Do you also embrace the challenge of interviewing someone about a topic that you're not super familiar with? It's pretty impossible to be an expert on everything of every guest that you're going to talk to. So what's some of the things that you've found the most refreshing to research and to look into?
It's truly driven by what's interesting to me and what I think is relevant. I mean, I have been, just to give you a small example, I have been deeply concerned about election security going into 2020, and deeply concerned that in the context of our current debates, and I don't mean just this impeachment inquiry, but I mean even against the backdrop of the Mueller report, I mean even truly since the 2016 election, it has been abundantly clear that we were completely sideswiped. We had no idea this was coming, although in hindsight, it turns out that the previous administration did know some and, had to grapple with difficult and nuanced considerations about how much to share with the American public. I think in hindsight, they probably should have shared more. So this needs to be talked about. And I've been frustrated for such a long time that we haven't talked about it. We finally did a really good election security program with Mark Warner, who we had done a previous one. We had a Angus King, who is an independent senator from Maine, on the Senate Intelligence Committee right around the time the Mueller report came out. But we also finally sat down with Mark Warner, who's a senior senator from Virginia, former governor of Virginia, and co-chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, along with the Republican Richard Byrd. And we're able to really do a deep dive into what are our true vulnerabilities still on the industry side, on the legislative side, and from the executive branch. And by the way, from the Defense Department, because that's actually a big part of our cyber, our ability to be proactive through cyber defenses is actually going to end up being a really big part of 2020 and securing our infrastructure in 2020. So impeachment inquiries are really important when they only come around, three times in the history of a representative democracy. On the other hand, the real challenge about ensuring that the result of 2020 is fair and accurate is ongoing.
So one thing that I think can be a real hindrance for people wanting to know more about these topics is they're complicated, right? And if they're only getting a surface level headline or a quick 5-minute newscast or something, they don't often know where to start to dive deeper. So when you're preparing your questions for your guests, how are you coming at that? Are you thinking of this person sitting on the couch watching your program?
1,000%. I mean, every interview is constructed in the way of a story. Is how we think about it. And start by trying to understand and introduce the guest to the audience in a personal way so they know what their credentials are and why they're sitting down in front of us and why they have reason to be sitting down and diving into whatever issue it is. And frankly, I like to connect with people. Like, I'm interested in people and who they are and what motivates them and why they're sitting in front of me doing what they're doing and what's gotten them to the point. So I've done a lot of research into them personally and try to find ways there's always something you like about people. And so I try to find the things that I like and that we can connect about and try to evoke that. So, because then I feel a personal connection to them, but that comes through on camera. The audience does too. And then we try to tell a story about the issue. I mean, there's always, for me, 3 or 4 things that I want answered or I want to get out of it or I want to see if the guest will play with. And that's sort of where I'm going. There's an arc to the conversation. And hopefully that makes the issues less menacing and more enjoyable.
With the original firing line, a big point of it was, quote, a balanced exchange of opinion, and the media landscape is ever more combative and the spirit of respectful debate and of public discourse is not what it once was. How do you think we can regain these skills as Americans?
Look, I think actually, Americans have it. I think we don't in the media. I think we don't in Congress. I think we don't in parts of the academy. What I am deeply concerned about is that we've created this, you know, there is a hyperpolarization in our politics and in our media that is actually doing us an enormous disservice. It's actually tearing us further apart. And by the way, the Russians are leveraging natural wedges in our society, and they're playing on them. I mean, we saw that in the Senate Intelligence Report that came out 2 weeks ago that demonstrated that the kneeling in the football team in the before the Pledge of Allegiance and the Star Spangled Banner at NFL games actually was amped up 10 times by Russian bots. This may not have even been a social issue that could have torn us apart on our respective cable news channels if we hadn't been so vulnerable to social media disinformation campaigns by foreign actors. So I think we've also created, frankly, a cycle of partisan media that is perpetuated by the profit margin. And we've also have the thing that Paul Ryan called the conservative industrial complex. There's one on the progressive side too, a progressive industrial complex. In other words, people who are invested and whose livelihoods are invested in continuing to make money on the polarization of our politics. And I think those two things combined, the partisan media combined with the partisan politics, perpetuates the sort of tearing apart of our civic discourse. And that's why what we do at Firing Line can only be on PBS in a way. I mean, we're privately funded. We don't have to race to the next break for a commercial. We can take the time to let an interview breathe, a set of ideas breathe. I have time to ask a follow-up question and then another follow-up question and then the follow-up to that follow-up. And so you get a really good sense of people and their ideas and what the issues are, whether it's Medicare for All or 2020 election security or gun control, right? We have the ability to do that. And the profit model hasn't demonstrated, although I think it'd be highly profitable, PBS has created a space for us to do that. And that's why I'm so grateful.
How does it feel for you to be part of, quote, the media that is often vilified and targeted these days for doing their work?
You know, it's interesting. The only reason I pause is because until this point in my life, I'd never considered myself a journalist. I haven't been. I'd been a commentator. I'd been an analyst. Even though I'd been on camera, I was never responsible for sort of unfolding the truth or trying to get at the truth with a guest. Mm-hmm. And it is more of a responsibility, and I take it really seriously. And look, the media is in the Constitution. The press is in the Constitution, protected in the First Amendment. And the attacks, mostly against the media, are coming from the right. And I have a very difficult time with the right, which has, at least for the time that I had been active in politics, working in Republican politics in the House of Representatives and in the executive branch in Washington, D.C., always being very quick to wrap its arms around the American flag and the Constitution, suddenly having a problem with the First Amendment or blaming the media for the problems that its party has come into. It doesn't sit well with me. And I think, again, it points to the problem that I mentioned earlier, which is this problem of partisan, hyper-polarized, hyper-partisan media is not serving our country well.
What are your goals in what you do with this program in trying to help shift that, and in what way you can?
Look, I mean, I think we're new. This is just the beginning of our second season, or we're approaching halfway through our second season. But I think the goal for the program is to continue to grow, to grow our audience. And one of the challenges we find now, and bless Milwaukee. Milwaukee airs us at 7:30 on Fridays, and we're very, very grateful. And we have a pretty robust following here in Milwaukee, which we're very happy about. But we want 100 Milwaukees. And, you know, so people can know where to find us and know how to tune in and can find us on all these multiple channels. So we're just really, we're growing, right? We've started, we have a great product, and we want to get the word out so we can engage more and more minds.
Now, I'd be remiss as a history nerd not to ask you about your family.
I love talking about Herbert Hoover more than almost anything.
Okay, great.
Maybe
great.
Even more than my small children.
Okay, so first random question. Do you have something of your great-grandfather's that is like just that you're really possessive of or is in your house or that is some sort of family heirloom?
I have a couple of things of his. I have my great-grandmother's copy of his book, American Individualism, which was the title I used for my book, American Individualism, which I published 10 years ago. I stand by every word I wrote, even though it's completely obsolete now. It was about how to not lose the millennials for the Republican Party. So, okay, that's fine. Maybe we lost that battle. But actually, that book, which my great-grandfather wrote, it was a sort of a treatise on how he, what he viewed was special and unique about the American system. He was an orphaned boy, son of a blacksmith and a Quaker minister from Eastern Iowa, of little to no means, and was entirely self-made. And at the time that he turned 40, he was living in London, which was the capital of mining finance. He was a self-made mining engineer, and he ended up in a position where he could organize the first international humanitarian food campaign to save an entire nation from starvation during World War I, which was the nation of Belgium. And he single-handedly created this entity, which became the template for humanitarian food relief operations. It became the template for UNICEF. Literally, Maurice Pate, whose work won UNICEF the Nobel Peace Prize in 1965, had worked for Herbert Hoover when he orchestrated Belgian food relief during World War I. So I get very, very excited about Herbert Hoover's legacy and the book he wrote right at the time. He was returning from Europe after feeding the Europeans after World War I. He wrote this book, American Individualism, which crystallized his philosophy for frankly, why his story was possible. An orphan boy from a frontier town in America could rise to the levels of engineering success, commercial success that he had experienced and wealth at that time. But also to be able to be in a position where he could make a huge difference in the lives of millions of people and be a prominent actor on the world stage at the signing of the Treaty of Versailles at the end of World War I. I mean, and so that book, that pamphlet was called American Individualism, and it was really, it was sort of like a, I mean, it was his testament to the values and the functions that make America possible and his story possible. And my great-grandmother's copy of American Individualism, which she kept with her, I have at home, and it's a deeply meaningful piece to me. I also have my parents, when I had published the book American Individualism, took my great-grandfather actually wrote 38 books. he was prolific. And his very first book contract they framed for me and gave me. So his book was called Principles of Mining. It was published in 1919, and it's still in print. This is like an extraordinary thing. So there are a lot of small mementos that are very meaningful. And frankly, it's just I'm so energized by Hoover's example. Because he truly is this person, even it was the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, he was a technologist, he was a person of the world, he was a problem solver, and he was a servant, a civil servant. And his example is an example, I think, that's so tangible right now.
Have you always been energized by your family's legacy, or have you had differing relationships with it as you've aged and learned more?
I always knew the side of Herbert Hoover that I'm espousing right now, but I also always knew the side that, like, most of my friends thought it was, like, something I should be embarrassed by, because there was, of course, this, you know, pejorative of Herbert Hoover's association with the Great Depression. And many of my friends and my friends' parents growing up just thought, no, isn't that a shame? You know, isn't that a shame she's related to Herbert Hoover? And, you know, I think, you know, of course, as we've learned more about modern macroeconomics, I think people understand that Hoover wasn't to blame for the Depression, that it happened 6 months after he became president. But that also, and certainly he made mistakes handling the Great Depression, but I think the Fed made much more mistakes, and that's quantifiable now. I think, you know, economists understand that. Mainstream historians are beginning to understand that. And with that new understanding, I think a new look at Hoover's legacy is in order.
With being a part of the Hoover family legacy, you mentioned his first book really instilled part of the way you view things. Are there any other family lessons that are instilled in you that have been passed down to generations that you in turn pass on to yours?
What I'd say is I think there's something about values. And Herbert Hoover was a Quaker. He was the first Quaker president. And, you know, my family is actually Episcopalian. Lew Henry Hoover was Episcopalian. Herbert Hoover was Quaker. Although he stopped going to Quaker meeting when he was Commerce Secretary because too many people at meeting in Washington, D.C. would be moved by the spirit to preach against his policies. So he really just, he was an avid fisherman, and I think that was his time with God. Sure. But, you know, a real reverence for public service, and public service in its most, I think, honest formulation, which is that you're there truly offering your services to the public. And, you know, I think there's a pragmatic problem solver that Hoover's example also yields and lends. And there's a real reverence for our institutions and reverence for the country and reverence for our founding documents and respect for the trust and faith that the American people put into office holders and real concern not to abuse that. So I think all of those values I grew up with, because even though I never knew Herbert Hoover, he died in 1964 and I was born in 77, so I missed him by 13 years. My dad was very close to him. My dad lived with him in the Waldorf Astoria for his last 20 years of his life in his post-presidency. He lived there, and my dad lived close by and lived with him even for a year as a small boy. So my dad and he had a very sweet relationship, and he knew him well, and I've gotten to know many people who knew him well. And I have been instilled with a real sense of his honor and his dignity and his kindness and how revered he was to the people who knew him very well. And then, and how much he cared about this country and our principles, and it really does get handed down. So I feel very blessed to have been exposed to a small, sort of interesting slice of American history, and I'm very proud of Herbert Hoover, and I'm very passionate, as you can see, about ensuring that his legacy is appropriately honored in history.
Margaret Hoover is the host of Firing Line with Margaret Hoover on PBS. She spoke with us while she was in town for an event at Milwaukee PBS, and you can find out more at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we have a commentary on the first national Thanksgiving, thanks to Abraham Lincoln. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Recently, friends and families got together to celebrate Thanksgiving. For contributor Art Sear, the holiday had him thinking about the very first White House proclamation in 1863 that declared Thanksgiving a national holiday.
Thanksgiving means real, not ideological, inclusiveness. President Abraham Lincoln profoundly demonstrated this fundamental point. On October 3, 1863, the White House issued the Thanksgiving Proclamation, declaring the last Thursday of November to be a, quote, day of thanksgiving and praise to our beneficent Father, who dwelleth in the heavens, unquote. Lincoln also humbly requested, quote, the interposition of the Almighty Hand to heal the wounds of the nation and to restore peace, harmony, and union, unquote. Earlier, Lincoln had ordered government offices closed on November 28, 1861, for a day of Thanksgiving. Up until the 1863 proclamation, individual states had celebrated days of giving thanks. Sarah Joseph Hale, editor of the influential Godey's Ladies book, had written to Lincoln in late September of that year pressing for a national day of thanks, a goal she pursued for many years without success. According to Lincoln's administrative aide, John Nicolay, Secretary of State William H. Seward signed the document. Lincoln and Seward by then were friends as well as colleagues. Unity was the overarching Lincoln theme throughout the Civil War, employed with shrewd calculation and brilliant political timing. By the fall of 1863, the strategic position of the Union had taken a marked turn for the better. In July, there were two significant victories: the Battle of Gettysburg in Pennsylvania, and the capture of Vicksburg, Mississippi. A sizable Confederate army never again would invade the North, and the great Mississippi River was now completely in Union control. During the preceding year, one military development provided Lincoln with political opportunity. On September 17, 1862, the Army of the Potomac, under General George B. McClellan, defeated General Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia at Antietam Creek in Maryland. The victory was technical in that Lee withdrew and left the Union forces in control of the field. Nevertheless, the outcome qualified as a Union military success, desperately welcome. Lincoln faced extremely serious challenges beyond the Confederacy. General McClellan was popular with rank-and-file soldiers. He also held national political ambitions. He was committed to the Union, but strongly opposed abolition of slavery. A talented organizer and administrator, he refused to be aggressive in attacking Lee's army. McClellan became insubordinate, demanding control over all war policy. The president fired him. McClellan became the Democratic Party's 1864 presidential nominee. Lincoln defeated him again. Lincoln's skill at civil military management was not limited to outmaneuvering McClellan. The president was instrumental in identifying and elevating promising Union commanders. The case of General Ulysses S. Grant is especially notable. This commander was persistent and determined in seeking victory, as viewed by many, but also much more. Grant had remarkable talent for inspiring cohesion and imposing effective organization, demonstrated early in the war in command of a company of volunteers. His skill at maneuver and speed in ensuring implementation of orders are equally impressive. The complaint that Grant was a butcher of men is unfair and untrue and reflects the terrible strains of that war. President Lincoln, after confirming control of the army, moved quickly to exploit the Antietam victory by issuing the Emancipation Proclamation. The executive order of January 1, 1863, freed slaves in the Confederate states. From the fall of 1862, the U.S. government issued a series of warnings under the Second Confiscation Act, passed by Congress on July 17, 1862. The legislation confirmed in law Lincoln's war powers. Critics have argued Lincoln should have included states in the Union, but that would have been illegal and unwise. Slavery was still legal under the Constitution and ended in law only when a sufficient number of states ratified the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, announced December 18, 1865. Slavery had support in border states and in parts of the Union. By design, the Emancipation Proclamation is a detailed, dry document that makes the case for returning property, with emphasis on procedure. There is no reference to fundamental moral concerns expressed eloquently elsewhere, especially in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and Second Inaugural. Immediately, Civil War goals changed from only restoring the Union to abolition of slavery. Lincoln used practical means for transcendent goals with astonishing political skill. Give thanks.
Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's a regular contributor to Lake Effect, and you can listen back to his past interviews and commentaries at WUWM.com. It's time now to kick off our 10th season of Bubbler Talk.
Bubbler Talk. Quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Jolly old St. Nicholas, lean your ear this way. Don't you tell a single soul what I'm going to say. Christmas Eve is
on December 25th, Santa Claus will have shimmied down many local chimneys and left presents under the tree. But today, some families are celebrating another holiday, St. Nick's Day. Depending on where you are in the world, St. Nick has many names, but the story is the same. In the U.S., he's celebrated in places with German or Dutch influence, like right here in Milwaukee. Some of you might be wondering, well, who is St. Nick, and where did this holiday come from? So is Bubbler Talk questioner Dawn, who asked about its origin.
My son was in, I think, first grade, and we were out at the bus stop, and a neighbor kid came over and said, "Hey, what'd you get for St. Nick's Day?" And both of us said, "What?"
For some background, I talked to John Schaefer, the vice president of Germanfest in Milwaukee. Schaefer says St. Nick was a real bishop, Greek-born, who died on December 6th in the 4th century. The holiday is rooted in Europe.
This Nicholas was known for producing small miracles and being kind to children, orphans, widows, and became the patron saints of merchants and so on and so forth.
Schaefer says European immigrants brought their St. Nick traditions here. There's an online center based out of Holland, Michigan, dedicated to all things St. Nicholas. And I talked to the president and founder, Carol Myers. She shared one of St. Nick's stories.
The most well-known story is about a man who had fallen on hard times and could no longer care for his family. He had three daughters of marriageable age, but was unable to provide dowries. so the daughters were going to be sold into slavery.
Meyer says St. Nicholas visited the man's house three times, tossing gold through the window for the dowry money, which might explain why children would get chocolate coin candy as gifts. Myers explains how people prepare for St. Nick's visit.
In many parts of Europe, people polish their shoes so they're very clean, their shoes and boots, and put them on the doorstep or the windowsill to be filled.
That's still common today, and people might also put out stockings. Myers also says the traditional treats are fruit, nuts, and candy. But some Milwaukee residents remember getting more than that. Here's Angela Harris.
My mom would make a box where it was like my Christmas pajamas. There would be like a movie that I wanted and like a mug or something for hot chocolate.
And Robert Dumville.
We would put out a shoe by the front door and we'd leave a carrot or an apple for his horse. And then in exchange, he would leave some sort of citrus fruit like an orange or tangerine and some sort of little sweet or chocolate. And usually, at least in our house, something to keep you warm.
And mother and daughter, Teresa Marion and Katie Meisner. Marion says she remembers Święty Mikołaj, that's St. Nicholas in Polish, as the start of the Polish Christmas holiday. She'd get a decorative Santa cup shaped like Santa's head and chocolate. And Meisner says St. Nick's Day was even more magical than Christmas.
We always got the same candy every year. We got a storybook, like, lifesaver candy set. We'd get a candy cane full of like Hershey's Kisses, and then we'd get just regular candy canes, and then there was always some sort of special toy, like something small that just fit in the stocking, you know?
Meisner continues the St. Nick's Day tradition with her daughters and says she hopes they'll do the same. If you missed the celebration this year, no worries. Now that you know a little more about St. Nick's Day, you have plenty of time to prep for his visit next December. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Potawatomi Hotel and Casino, home to 24/7 entertainment, dining, and musical acts, plus Ember Salon and Spa, and Topgolf Swing Suite. More at paysbig.com. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
We'll take one last break, and then our next guest, a bioethicist, considers the ethical consequences of medical technology like genetic testing. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that conversation right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Merriam-Webster defines ethics as, quote, a set of moral principles, a theory or system of moral values, end quote, and, quote, the principles of conduct that govern an individual or a group, end quote. Well, our next guest makes his living applying both definitions to such fields as bioethics, digital medicine, end-of-life issues, public health and research ethics, and health policy. Craig Klugman is a professor of bioethics and health humanities at the Department of Health Sciences at DePaul University in Chicago. He's also the author of more than 450 articles, book chapters, and blog posts on bioethics. Dr. Klugman was in Milwaukee last month to deliver the Medical College of Wisconsin's annual Medical Humanities Lecture, and Bonnie North welcomed him to the studio then.
Craig Klugman, it is such a pleasure to have you on Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I want to start with the notion of ethics. Let's start big.
Okay.
How much time do you have, right?
I got all day.
Yeah, okay. Why is there such a focus, do you think, on ethics, particularly bioethics right now? What is driving the interest, public interest?
Well, I think life is changing so fast. I mean, if you think about artificial intelligence, if you think about we now can have babies that exist in bags, at least for lambs, we're working on that. And if you think about genetics, that now, you know, in your kitchen, you could actually manipulate genetics of a small organism. And things are happening such a rapid pace that the question becomes, should we be doing this? How we should be doing this? Should we be regulating it? Should we be allowing just anybody to do this or restricting it more? So we get these big stories like last year, the birth of the two girls who were in genetically engineered embryos, and we get end of life issues. And people have been struggling for the last 50 years about how to make sense of these rapid changes in technology and medicine, that we're left with this question of what should we do and what should we not do. And so bioethics has sort of arisen to have these public conversations, both on a professional level and on a community level.
It feels to me like ethics has lagged behind the technological advances that, you know, it, as you say, it's moving so fast mm-hmm. that you just barely get your head around one thing and five others pop up.
I say that I spend most of my time as an academic just keeping up with the news, trying to know what's going on and happening. Yes. So if we think about the technology happens, and what we try to do in ethics is react to that as well as anticipate it, right? So we want to get to the point where we've created frameworks and structures that exist, and we can think about these new adaptations happening. But we also are in the situation of we're much faster than anything they can do in law or regulation. So if the technology is happening at light speed, the ethics is happening at the speed of sound, and regulation is kind of the turtle bringing up the rear.
I was going to say geological time.
Yeah. Basically glacial sorts
of
things.
Is there any movement to actually bring ethicists on board with technology teams?
There's a little bit. So there's some of us who do consultations. I was working for a few years with a pharmaceutical company that was doing a high-tech intervention. And so they brought on a team of ethicists to sort of figure out what are the issues? What do we need to be concerned about? And they changed things based on what we suggested. They changed their consent process. We had a social justice concern about who would have access to these technologies. And so they actually went out and made sure that people could have access to it, which required going to the FDA and having them change some of their rules. And it took years, but it happened. But as far as artificial intelligence and cars, they're looking at less working with people in ethics. Google famously put together an ethics group to deal with its AI program. And that group lasted less than a week before they were disbanded, in part because they weren't using so much professional ethicists as people who were politically good for their bottom line.
Or motivated in a different way.
Yeah, I'm trying to be polite here.
I guess.
But there was so much outrage over some of the people they were having on their committee that they actually disbanded it within a week. So it has not been as much as we'd like to see, as much as the thoughtfulness. You know, we get wrapped up with this new technology and the excitement of it and the things we can do and the lives we can change, that sometimes we just need to breathe and take a pause. And I think that's what we do in ethics, is we create a sacred space where we can have these conversations as communities, as individuals, in the hospital, outside the hospital, in the state house, in the corporate boardrooms, to ask, you know, what direction should we be going?
But I'll bet that there's a certain amount of people accusing you of being wet blankets.
So there are people who have written and saying that we exist to prevent technology from moving forward, that we exist to stop research. And the reality is we're not, that good ethics makes for good research. Good ethical thought leads to better technologies that, you know, help improve lives rather than just being focused on improving the bottom line. So for example, a lot of people are concerned when they have to go through a human subjects review board that this is preventing them from doing their work. But the reality is the most basic part of that is, are you doing good science? Like, we shouldn't be wasting the time and energy of bringing in research subjects and exposing them to potential harms if there's nothing good that will come out of it. And so we actually force you to make sure you're doing good science. That's primary.
And we also don't want a repeat of Tuskegee or any of those other kinds of things that have been proven to not only be bad science, but really horrific to the participants who didn't know what they were getting into.
Exactly. We want to make sure that there's transparency and honesty and that people are doing science that benefits society as well as doesn't harm people, you know, just because they're members of a group or, there's lots of research that could be done if we didn't care what happened to the subjects. And, you know, we have Tuskegee, we have the Nazi era, we have the radiation experiments, we have the Guatemala syphilis studies. I mean, we're finding things all the time, unfortunately. But we want to make sure that we do stuff that is good for people and good for technology and good for society overall.
You talked about having something that we get excited about and we're not thinking through all of the implications. And of course, the first thing that comes to my mind is 23andMe, Ancestry.com. To put, you know, not that they're bad. It's that we don't know what's being done with that information. It's really cool to know that, you know, you have family members over in some place you had no idea. And all of the shows that come up, you know, that people are saying, finding out about their ancestry, finding out all of these things. We love that. As humans, we want that story. But how do we regulate that? How do we apply ethics to that so that whatever we find out isn't used against us?
Well, there hasn't been regulation of this space. Remember that 23andMe was founded by the wife of one of the Google founders. So these are not companies that really are in the business of finding out who your family members are or finding out what diseases you might have. They're in the business of collecting data. You know, we are the product. We are not the customer. The customer are researchers and governments and data banks. That's who they're going after. We just provide the content for them, and we're paying for that right to do it. There's challenges that come with this, with having your information out there. I mean, we do have a law called GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Disclosure Act, which protects you from having your genetic information used in employment or health insurance. But that doesn't apply to long-term care insurance. It doesn't apply to life insurance. It doesn't apply to whether you get a job in the first place necessarily, or where you live, whether you have access to different types of assistive devices or can get different types of support from the government. It actually is a pretty weak law. So these things can be used against us in the future. And it's not just us, because when you provide that DNA sample, you're actually connecting 300 of your closest relatives. This has come up a lot recently in cases like the Golden State Killer, where now we have law enforcement wanting to use these databases, and they're really great databases to catch killers. And they're people who do not exist in the federal database for criminals, right? So those tend to be people who are people of color because they're more likely to get involved with the and to get arrested and get convicted in the system. And so people who were more white, who were not in those other, the federal databases, now we're able to find the connections that they committed these crimes. But we're actually not looking for them. We're looking for their families. So, you know, Golden State Killer was found and somebody found a third cousin and then was able to link the, reconstruct the family tree. If you look at the terms of use for Ancestry and 23andMe, none of them guarantee you privacy. They do have privacy statements, but it's that they will, you know, strip away your name if they use things. But your DNA is an identifier by itself. And there have been a lot of studies that come out of MIT's done quite a few of them that show it is pretty easy to re-identify, de-identify data. So if my third cousin, who I don't even know, puts their stuff in, people can find out information about me, even though I've never done it. I've told my immediate family never to do it.
I have never done it, even though I am tempted, because it would be fun to find that stuff
Absolutely.
Out. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, day one of my intro to bioethics class, I tell students we'll do our genetics chapter, but before we get there, don't do these. Don't buy it for a gift for someone. Because if you read those terms again, it says for entertainment purposes only. So even
so, that's how they get around the ethical issues.
Right. They also had been giving some health advice for a while. The FDA called them out on that. And now they have to submit for each disease that they're better indicators. But there's so many things we don't know about the whole DNA area. I mean, there's no regulation on the laboratories. You give three laboratories the same sample, they're going to give you three different things because they're looking for different markers. They have different databases to compare to. There are cases of people finding out that they are one ethnicity or from one particular geographic region. And then a few years later, they're given an update and they're a totally different ethnicity because the database has expanded during that time. So this is not as certain. It's not like watching CSI and it's, you know, we always get our person. It changes as we learn more information and because there's no standard for how the labs run.
So how do you, as a professional ethicist and somebody who's trying very hard to get people to understand the ripples of all of this, how do you get them to do that? How do you say, hey, look, this is what you're doing. This is what you're giving away. when you sign up for one of these things?
So in part, we do public conversations. Like, I'm here to give the 14th Annual Medical Humanities Lecture at MCW. So we bring the public in to talk about these things. We teach in our classroom. We write op-eds. We write blogs. We actually talk to our legislators and try and get them on board and understand what's happening. We try to get people engaged to know that this is happening and to try and get their elected officials and their family not to do it and to think about what regulations we need and what laws we want to pass.
Even though those will be slow in getting passed.
It'll be very slow, but you know, this is a long-term project. This is the future of humanity. So we're not about the short-term getting an answer today. We want to lay out good frameworks and good structures for tomorrow.
One of the other things that you do that I have to say I found really fascinating is your art rounds. And this we're kind of shifting gears here away. Well, ethics still play a part in this, but I love the idea of visual literacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping you can tell us a little more about what you mean by that and why it's important for health professionals in particular to have it.
So we live in a very visual culture, right? We've with the rise of cell phones and emojis, language is, you know, the textual language is becoming less and less of what we do and so much more of the visual, you know, Netflixing and, you know, watching TV and graphic imagery. So we have to understand what these images are and what they mean and where they come from. And so the idea of visual literacy, especially in medicine, is that a lot of medicine is just looking at people. You know, you come up with a differential diagnosis based on their symptoms, but sometimes just looking at a person, you can see what fits, what doesn't fit. And as a patient, to be seen is a really profound experience. It creates a connection to your healthcare provider. There is a sense of a placebo effect, just being seen and heard and witnessed. And so what we've been doing with art is trying to increase visual literacy and visual observation skills through the use of museum art, and that's the Art Rounds program. And so we take medical students and nursing students, so we make them work together because even though we train them separately, when they're in the clinic, they work in teams together. So we make them work together, and we teach them a process called VTS, Visual Thinking Strategies, which is actually used for little kids to teach them how to engage in art. And it's three simple questions. What do you see? What do you see that makes you think that? What more do you see? And we do this over and over. And we'll look at a single piece of art for a half hour. Now, the average person in a museum looks at a piece of art for 8 seconds.
I was going to say 2 minutes. I was being generous.
Yeah, no, yeah. 8 seconds. Yeah. There's been studies on this. And so to have to look at a piece for that long, you really begin to see things. And this is a skill that you can develop so that the next time, maybe you don't need to spend 30 minutes looking. One of the things we did in Art Rounds was how do you take looking at a piece of art and then bring that to the clinic when you're looking at a patient? So we got models, and we put models in the galleries. And on the very last session, we do multiple sessions, we have the students look at the models as if they are a piece of art, and they're describing things. And for the models, when you ask them what this experience was like, they felt very exposed because their every flaw is being pointed out, every little mark, every, you know, one nostril's higher than the other, just things that most of us would never realize or ignore or want to know about. We've done some pre and post review of this assessment and found that actually having them make the transition to the patient model from the piece of art gives them that transference ability. And, you know, the patients feel more seen, more witnessed, more observed. And in the long run, this can save money in the healthcare system because you don't necessarily have to rely on the high technology if you can just spend time looking and seeing, oh, they have this mark. They don't have this thing that's often common in this case.
It sounds like it's an offshoot of the standardized patient, the idea of a real person coming in and you having to do a differential diagnosis as a medical student. You know?
And actually, we started it through the standardized patient program.
Oh, did
program.
You? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that makes sense because it sounds like it would be something that would help that.
I mean, there's kind of an irony in this, isn't that part of the whole work of the medical humanities is helping healthcare providers see patients as people with their full rich stories and histories and experiences. And yet we're putting people in a gallery and saying, look at them as objects. So there's a little piece of this that bothers me that we're doing it, but we also let the students know that, you know, this is not how you address a patient where you just stare at them for a half hour and point out all their flaws, that this is just a tool that they're learning along the way.
It helps them see better.
It does.
That's the idea.
It does. Yeah. And, You know, we spend so little time looking at things anymore. You know, 8 seconds in a museum where you're going a place to look. But, you know, when you're scrolling through your feeds on your phone, when you're driving, you just, things barely enter your consciousness anymore. And we're just trying to say, slow down, take a moment, just look. And you will be much more effective as a healer, and your patients will feel much more appreciated.
What would you say to the patients? What's the reverse? Do they need to be paying attention in the same way?
Well, you know, one of my projects with the medical humanities is that it's not just for healthcare providers, that it's for everybody, because we are all either future patients or future lay caregivers. And yes, you should be paying attention to what your doctor does. Are they looking at you? Do they make eye contact, or are they just staring into a computer screen the whole time, which many healthcare systems actually encourage? And to ask for what you need. I need you to look at me when I say this. You know, I want you to see this rash I have. There's something unusual about it. You need to ask for what you want and need as a patient, because it's not necessarily there anymore because we've become such a corporatized system of healthcare.
Right, which is one of the big complaints. You're just a number.
Sometimes you feel that way. Very often you feel that way.
Right. Which is what you're hoping to move people away.
We are. We're trying to take doctors and medical students who are trained to take standardized tests, and that there are right and wrong answers. And by injecting the humanities into their training, we're teaching them there's no right answer. There's no right way to interpret a piece of art. There's no right answer to what this, you know, misty thing is in the background. There's what you see. So we get them comfortable with ambiguity, which is something we do not teach in med school, where it's all there is a right answer and there's a wrong answer.
That, in science, ambiguity is a difficult thing. Yeah.
Yes. And science itself is what we read in a journal article is the outcome of interpretation of data and observation. And you know, all of this, the subjectivity of science and medicine is something that we don't talk about that often, which is why the humanities approaches is so important for people who are professionally going to be doing this, to understand that, you know, a data point is not necessarily just a number. There's a story behind it, and what it means depends on the context in which it exists.
And that's where the ethics come in, too.
And then you round back to ethics.
Exactly. Yes. Well, Craig Klugman, it has been such a pleasure. I have enjoyed this thoroughly. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Craig Klugman is a professor of bioethics and health humanities at the Department of Health Sciences at DePaul University in Chicago. He's also the co-director of the university's minor in bioethics and society. Klugman was in Milwaukee last month to deliver the medical humanities lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North then. You can learn more about Professor Klugman's work at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the show today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.